thing. I now know they're very directive, so I now know that I'm going to need an antenna rotor, but I'll report back next week. I'll have all the answers to how accurate this motor positioning is going to be.
Okay, very good, Rich. As always, we wish you the best of luck, and I can't wait for the next episode.
I remain as intrigued as I am intimidated by the objective. Very cool. KQ-VHD.
There's postage stamp amount of property to work with, and I never thought in a million years that a MAG loop could perform the way this one is performing. I hope it's because how fat I chose to make the elements, but we'll see. I'll take it just as it is right now, because I only need to retune when I move a considerable distance on 20 meters. It's holding the SWR for half of the band. It's not changing that much, so I think that's because I have a real thick, two real thick elements, the coupling loop and then the radiating loop. So, all right, back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Well, once again, it's great to hear success and having it with us. I hope it continues, and I look forward to how the servo works, and then eventually getting rotators don't have to be terribly expensive. They still sell RCA rotators at a reasonable price. I've seen new ones at a little bit over $100 with controllers, and you might be able to pick up a used one for less. So the world's your oyster.
Yep, I put the, I got a 12-volt battery, a lead-acid battery, and I put that in a little ammo box, plastic, not metal, because the Wi-Fi has to talk back and forth. So I put that in with the controller card, and I flip it closed, and carry it with a little handle right beside the antenna when I move it indoors and outdoors. So it's been quite a fun project. And again, I've never heard louder signals on my Kenwood 440 in 35 years, and this magnetic loop is producing. So we'll see. I'm pretty confident that the memory function is going to work out fine. Back to net, W2BZ.
AC2GS. Well, good for you. Yeah, wish you the best. I'll be curious to see if there's any wanted directionality in that box, because the Wi-Fi module probably is not going to like the Wi-Fi signal going through the lead and the lead-acid battery. So you might get into the habit of orienting the box such that the antenna array is closer to you and away from the battery portion of the box.
Yeah, I made a couple of QSOs today with it. Didn't seem to matter. But it's something to think about, Roy. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, it really ultimately depends upon the gain of the Wi-Fi module and the strength of your Wi-Fi transmitter and the distance between you and it. But I was just thinking in terms of what might be a problem. Obviously, lead-acid... old technology, but the durable technology, but it will block RF in that place. So, okay, once again, good luck, and we're all looking forward to bigger and better stories. Maybe you'll push this guy into opening his own business.
I tell you, if this works, it's a game changer, because anybody who thinks they can use a magnetic loop and not be sitting right next to it to keep on retuning it is crazy. You can't do it. It can't be done. You have to have a way to remotely turn that capacitor to bring the antenna into resonant at different frequencies. There is no other way to do it. And there, the commercial manufacturers really don't bring that up a lot. You know, they don't say, you know, if you're going to be in a ham shack and have the antenna outside, that you must have a remote controller. They don't say that, but I'm telling you, you must have a remote controller.
Okay, I hope for the sake of amateur radio operators that they're aware that manually tuned antennas, you need to be in a position to manually tune them. In the case of you have something completely different, like the MSJ whip with the alligator clip on a coil, obviously you need to be able to reach that coil if you're going to change the resonant frequency of it. So I hope not too many people are surprised when they unpack their relatively inexpensive manual magnetic loop and discover that they have to trudge over to the loop every time they want to significantly change the resonant frequency.
Comment?
Yes, please. Yes, someone wants to comment?
KC2SCJO again. Why is it so difficult, though? Why couldn't it be a set of different value capacitors and relays like a lot of these automatic tuners use? Would it be that difficult to implement a similar topology or, you know, whatever term you want to use there for something of that nature instead of, you know, a variable? Why couldn't it be a bunch of capacitors being switched in and out until it finds resonance and then sitting there?
Well, in the case of a magnetic loop, the Q is so high that most times people build a good quality manual magnetic loop, they don't just put a knob at the end of the variable capacitor. They put a vernier, a gear reduction device, because, you know, just a twitch of your finger and you pass the resonant frequency. So the problem is the granularity of switched in, you know, standard set capacitances. Also, you get a problem with the insertion losses. You're probably going to lose more power with the connections and the relays and all the gears that need to implement that. So probably the primary problem is just the sheer need for very, very fine granularity when it comes to making it resonant.
As usual, right? Great answer. Thank you, sir. EC2, GS, back to that, KC2, SHO.
You're welcome, John, and everyone else is welcome. Thank you all for participating tonight. I always say it, and I'll say it again, that you guys that make or break a technical net. This is not an opportunity for me to go on monologue, so I appreciate your participation on a weekly basis. It is now 10:17, certainly time for Paul and the SpaceNet report.
Okay, very good. This is WS2N with the Space Report. Thank you, Roy, for everything. Very good night tonight. And I just wanted to bring up one interesting thing I saw today. Nothing to do with ham radio, but I was visiting someone near Republic Airport and flying around the area. I was outside with this Austria military vehicle. That's one of these planes that fly horizontally and then they turn the rotors and come down vertically. And then after I've seen pictures before, it's, you know, on TV, and but I never saw one in person. And I guess they were practicing or something. They were going around and around, and they'd land and take off again. Pretty interesting. I don't know if anybody's ever seen one of those things. Well, okay. Unfortunately, I couldn't get my phone, which has to take a picture of it. I thought about it too late, and it was gone. And by the way, at full speed, those things go like 300 miles an hour. But it was going relatively slow, around and around. Yeah, first thing I wanted to talk about was the news about NASA choosing another company, another space company, to land on the moon, to help the Artemis program. Right now I have SpaceX, they signed them up for multi-billion dollar program about 2 years ago now. They signed them up where they would use their Starship, the one that hasn't really even orbited Earth yet. They would use that to eventually land on the moon. It would go out to the orbit of the moon and wait there, you know, unmanned, and they would wait for the Artemis Orion spacecraft to show up. And they would transfer two people to that vehicle, the other two astronauts would stay in the command Orion vehicle, and they would fly down to the moon, do what they have to do for maybe a week, and then return to dock with Orion, and then from there Orion would return, and in the beginning they wouldn't reuse that Starship, but the plan is eventually to have a reusable Starship. That was chosen a couple of years ago, and NASA usually likes to have a redundancy built into everything. You know, when they had Pioneer spacecraft investigator Jupiter and they'll fly out to Saturn, you know, you had Pioneer 10, Pioneer 11. You know, the theory was in case one failed, the other one could possibly make it. Voyager was the same thing with Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 still operating today, launched in 1977. They both did very good. They wanted to investigate the outer planets, Uranus and Neptune. So they could have done it with both of them. They only had Voyager 2 actually go out and do that. The reason why was because they wanted to investigate the moon Titan around Saturn. But to do that, they needed to change the direction a little bit with Voyager 1 to go close to that moon, which they did. And it was a cloud-covered moon, and they thought if they get in close, they'll be able to see what was there. They really didn't get much out of that by doing that. And sure enough, the trajectory changed, and they were not able to use Voyager 1 to investigate the other planets. But they had a plan B. It was redundancy. They could afford to gamble like that. With the Artemis program, they decided, well, let's just let SpaceX do it. They said, well, we're a little low of money, and we'll just leave this one contract alone. Well, time went by, and they realized, you know, we really need redundancy. So NASA, you know, put out a request for anybody, any companies that would like to bid on this, and you know, they have to submit their proposals, what the vehicles look like somewhat, and their capabilities and all. And there were a couple of companies that wanted to do that, and Blue Origin was one, run by Jeff Bezos of Amazon, and then there was another one, Dynetics. That was another competing company. Dynetics was going to work with Northrop Grumman, you know, and which is was almost sounds like the right thing, because Grumman was the one that built the LM. But you know, they finally decided on Blue Origin, which you know, if you read about it, I believe that it's really a good decision. So they're giving them a multi-billion-dollar contract. I think it's $3.4 billion. But to develop this lander, Blue Origin also told them, you know, it's going to cost, like, way more than that, like, at least $7 billion to do it. So it's Blue Origin, now they got plenty of money. They're gonna kick in the rest of that money, and it's still going to be a fixed price for NASA, $3.4 billion. So NASA went with them. They're involved with other companies as well. They're involved with Lockheed Martin. They're involved with astrobiotic. Boeing is involved with them, Draper, a company called Honeybee Robotics, and these companies are all going to be involved with this vehicle called Blue Moon. That's what they're calling it, Blue Moon, and that will be the one that lands on the surface of the moon. You know, now how is this different than SpaceX? SpaceX got massive rockets, one big piece is going to come down, you know, roughly almost 200 feet tall, not quite that tall, but, you know, up there, and it's going to land vertically, and astronauts are going to have to get out and have some kind of cable system or, you know, an exotic stairway or some way to get down to the surface and then all the way back up to the top again. When they finish it, this thing is going to take off and go back up and meet with Orion. And now this is all with the first landing mission. You have Artemis II that's coming up. Artemis II is just a crewed mission, not going to the moon, but just going around the moon and coming back. Those four astronauts have already been chosen. That will be at the end of 2024. 2025, the end of 2025, we're supposed to actually have this lunar landing with a Starship from SpaceX meeting Orion at lunar orbit, and they will be the transfer vehicle. But after that, now NASA has given the contract to Blue Origin for Artemis 4, Artemis 5, and some of the ones after that will be also Blue Origin. Now, how is it different that you have one big piece for SpaceX? This thing is going to come down. It looks like it's going to be like the LEM project on steroids. You know, LEM was about 21 feet high. It had a diameter of like maybe 14 feet. This thing is over five stories high. You know, 50 plus feet high. The diameter is going to be like 21 feet in diameter, because that's what's going to fit inside Blue Origin's heavy lift rocket that they're building. They haven't flown it yet. It's called the New Glenn. New Glenn's going to have the biggest diameter bearing of anybody. And, you know, they call it a 7 meter of over 21 foot diameter bearing. So this vehicle will probably weigh over 40 tons. Picture that they put out, you know, NASA put it out, picture, preliminary what it looks like. Roy put it up on his web page. It's up there now. If you haven't seen it on the internet, it's a good picture because it shows two little astronauts walking down, you know, on the surface of the moon. Gives you a good perspective of how big this thing is going to be. It's like, you know, 2.5 times bigger, taller than the LEM that landed 6 times on the moon. So it's also got some other advantages. It'll be able to stay on the moon for a very long time. The initial plans are just to usually last no more than 2 weeks. This thing would be able to go a whole month if they really wanted to, because they plan on using fuel cells on board the Blue Moon lander. So they won't need solar panels. They're going to use fuel cells, which, you know, that's what the space shuttle had, but that's what Apollo had. And also some of the later, from Gemini 5 on, they used fuel cells. And, they could run, you know, for hours and hours, not only hours, but days on end. So that's another advantage of Blue Moon. The engine has been tested a gazillion times, they said. I don't even think they know how many times it's tested, but it's called the R7 engine, and so they plan on using that engine to to land on the moon, but then it looks like they're going to have an ascent module similar to what the LEM was as well. And that looks like that will go up to the space station. The whole setup is supposed to be reusable. So I'm not really sure exactly how they're going to do this. I mean, to me, the whole thing would have to take off and go back with the Gateway space station. Gateway space station. And of course, it's not there yet, but that'll be orbiting the moon. So we'll have to see how that's all going to work out. They also have another plan with Lockheed, like I said, but different companies are involved with this Blue Moon system. Lockheed plans on building a fuel transfer vehicle. Blue Moon system is basically going to use a lot of liquid oxygen, of course, but liquid hydrogen. Liquid hydrogen is very hard to store. You know, NASA's been doing it for years. They've used it for a lot of scientific, like telescopes, hydrogen doesn't stay in completely tight, very thin molecules. But they're developing a way to store it. It's called 100% leak-free. Blue Origin is working with Lockheed to develop this. And they plan on eventually developing a transfer vehicle. In other words, you can launch hydrogen from Earth, fly it out to the moon, and recharge or refuel the Blue Moon lander, which will be able to do multiple landings. Anytime a crew comes out, this thing will be able to transfer and go down to the lunar surface. And it's not supposed to be a throwaway system. So that's why I haven't figured out what they're going to do with this this landing system. We'll have to see over time. So I think it was a good move to do that. We'll see how it goes. Their first launch will probably be in 2028. They plan on landing on the moon unmanned. And they plan on, it looks like, two missions like that. NASA wasn't even requiring this. They said, well, this is what we're going to do. So, much better reason to go with this company. So that would be great. If they can pull this all off. Any questions or comments? WS1. Well, we'll see. Hopefully, I'll be able to, see upgraded designs probably within 6 months or so. They should start putting them out. If you remember the LEM when I was first being designed, they had many, many pictures that came out early on, and it evolved and it changed over time to what it looks like today. And I'm sure the same thing is going to happen with the Blue Moon system. That lander will probably change multiple times. How they're going to go about doing this. Another reason they chose Blue Origin is this lander is also going to be capable of sending materials down to the lunar surface. They said, like, up to 20 tons at a time. That's a lot of, we're talking about food, solar panels, who knows, equipment, science equipment. They'll be able to transfer up to 20 tons to the lunar surface with the Blue Moon system. So between the cargo capability, the refueling system that they're talking about with Lockheed, sending four people down instead of two. SpaceX wants to send two down to the surface. Landing anywhere on the moon, they're going to have the capability of going everywhere, although in the beginning they will be only landing on the south pole of the moon, near the Shackleton crater. Okay, any comments before I move on? WS1. Okay. Here's another interesting story that I found that NASA is getting involved with. One of the biggest problems astronauts have is severe dizziness, especially after a flight. When they come back to Earth, you know, their orientation as well. As well, it takes them a while to reorient themselves. But on Earth, it's okay. You know, I have doctors, medical, you know, people right there to help them out if need be. When they first launch into space, they have I think they say around 50% of the astronauts that do get sick in space, it takes a little bit of time to, you know, maybe a day or so, to straighten themselves out. But they would like to be able to find certain techniques, moving your head a certain way or doing certain things. They would like to find out what they can possibly do, if anything at all, to prevent this. Especially when you not only go to the moon, but let's say eventually you go to Mars. Last thing you need to do after a 9-month flight to Mars is land there and be totally dizzy. Not only on the way down, but when you land there and now you got to try to get up, you're not going to have a medical team, you know, unless you have, you know, civilization there, you know, before you land. But in the beginning, you're going to have nothing. You're going to have to depend on you and your crew. So to try to help this dizziness feeling, they plan on using this machine that the Air Force has, located in Ohio, and it's a massive contraption. I mean, it looks like hundreds of feet long. It's got big, gigantic motors attached to this thing. And what it is, you know, you would go inside this thing, and it's a simulation machine. You would go inside and sit down. You could actually sit two people in this machine. And it could spin. And it could spin in six different axes, all different kinds of directions. And the idea is, you know, let's say you're on a simulated, you're flying off of a carrier deck, or you're flying somewhere, or your plane is out of control, you've got to try to bring it back. You have, looks like windows all around, like you're inside of a fighter jet or something. And you've got to try to, you know, work with this thing. And this thing will spin and give you the sensation of, like, taking off of you know, real quick. Coming down, spinning, coming down, and they say it's very realistic. So the Air Force has been using this to train some of their pilots, and now NASA is going to use it as well. You know, the thing is used 24 hours a day, so, but NASA wants to use it to see if they can work with astronauts. And that will be a big advantage for astronauts in the future. But also, once they devise a way, if there is a certain way of, like, moving ahead or doing something physical or maybe medication or whatever, if they could find a way to compensate for that problem, they could actually help patients on Earth, people that have had tumors removed from their ears. If those kind of operations take place, well, Dr. Roy would know better than me. In some cases, it would create dizziness, severe dizziness in patients. If they knew a procedure to compensate for that, you know, you can actually help patients on Earth. So I thought that was interesting. This thing is called the Kraken. You know, they actually titled it, you know, Release the Kraken. Some movie. By the way, I've never seen that. Anyway, I know that was a famous thing saying for a couple of years. But that's what the thing is called, the Kraken. Now, if you go to, I saw it on the NASA website, but I made a tiny URL out of it. So you can actually go to that website, it's actually a NASA website, and then you just scroll down to, you know, where the pilot is sitting in. Looks like a jet cockpit. What he's sitting in is really inside this machine. But you click on that, you can see all the different ways this thing spins. And it's really quite a machine. But I don't know, I'll just give out the, I made a tiny URL out of it. The actual URL is way too long. But if anybody wants to look it up, it's https://tinyurl.com/y, like in Yankee, 29, E is an echo, H is in hotel, 6, A is in alpha, and K is in kilo, or cracker. Any comments, WS1. Okay, nothing heard. Gave echo. Echo, chance. Okay, there's another mission that I've been following for years. Juno mission. Juno is a large spacecraft with large solar wings. Solar wings, one end to the other, 120 feet. It's been flying around Jupiter since 2016. And the reason I'm talking about it is within a day or so, it's going to be coming very close to the volcanic moon Io and, on one of its passes. And then in the near future, it's going to actually come, right now it's going to be 22,000 miles away, which is about the distance the geosynchronous satellites are, like some of our countless satellites that we have going around orbit around Earth. So it seems like it's pretty high, but in the near future, it'll be going maybe as close to 1,000 miles above the surface. The orbit has adjusted itself where it could do this. Juno comes around from the north pole of Jupiter, and then it goes down sort of polar orbit, comes back out on the south pole. Originally, when it went into orbit, it was like 52 days it would take to make one complete orbit. The goal was to make it down to around 14 days. They thought they could do that because each time, it'll be an elliptical, very elliptical path that Juno takes. Goes close, into radiation type of areas, but then when it goes further out, then it transmits information back to the deep space network. So they wanted to go into this 14-day orbit instead of this 50-plus-day orbit. And they realized I had a problem with their main engine. They knew it worked, but they thought there was a leak in it, and they were afraid that, if they turned it on one more time, it could cause an explosion. So they figured, well, we'll leave it at this 50-day orbit for now. We'll get the same amount of science, but it's going to take us like years, which it already has many, many years. Instead of the original plan was 33 months. But they figured, we have patience, we can do it. It's all solar powered, so it's not going to run out of power. And then we got creative. As it would go around the planet, sometimes it would get very close to a moon, they would use the moon as a gravitational instead of acceleration, a deacceleration. And eventually they were able to start changing the timing of the orbits from, 50 days, they got it down to 40 days, 30, and now I think they're down to where they wanted to be, like 14 days. So now they're getting science at a much higher rate without that engine, just by orbital mechanics. And so Juno is doing good. I remember when it took off, it would go around the sun a couple times, and then eventually use the Earth as a gravity assist, start heading out to Jupiter. But early on in that program, one of the gadgets and instruments that are on board is called a plasma detector, and they wanted to, early on. Like I said, it went into orbit around 2016, when it was still near Earth, 2013. They wanted to test out the plasma sensor. And to do that, they got the idea to use amateur radio. They put a request out for the ARRL, anybody worldwide that could participate, and they would send Morse code. I mean, very slow Morse code. I mean, each dot was like 10 seconds. You know, we had to send out the word hi, you know, so they were all dots, you know. So it was, you know, and I did it was like forever just to send that. And then you would pause, and they let you know, by a clock, everybody had a certain time, one to push the key down and one to release the key. And to eventually send out the word hi. I remember doing that, participating, and also H2LR, Kate did that as well. Along with about 3,000 people from around the globe. And they felt collectively, if everybody's doing this at the same time, the signal would be picked up by the plasma gadget on the Juno spacecraft. So as time went on, sure enough, we found out that it did work, and everybody was promised a QSL card. And the months went by, and, you know, no QSL card, you know, which is no big surprise. I mean, that's what we're used to anyway. But sure enough, around 6 or 7 months later, we got QSL cards in the mail. I still have that on my shelf here. Frame contact with a spacecraft that was on the way to Jupiter. Any comments? WS2N. Okay, I heard a station, but noisy, so try again, please.
K2LOR.
Oh, okay. K2LOR, I believe it is. This is WS2N, name here is Paul. Pictures of Europa. So the goal is to eventually send the spacecraft out. We'll have the capability of scanning underneath the surface of Europa. And by the way, there's other moons as well. Ganymede, they believe, is similar. Now they think that holds out water underneath. So Juno doesn't have that capability, you know, to take pictures and all. I mean, actually, the main purpose of Juno was to actually investigate the planet itself, you know, everything that went on with Jupiter. And the moons were like, a sideshow for Juno. Galileo gave us a lot of information. But now that's not in orbit anymore. They deorbited that. They let it burn up in the atmosphere when it was time. But that is another mission. Actually, it's on the way now from the European Space Agency. We have one under development. We're going to launch it yet, called the Europa Clipper, which will eventually come very close to that moon many, many times every time it goes around in orbit. But there's one actually on the way to those moons. And that's called JUICE. I might have talked about it last week I've talked about so many of these things over the months and years. But JUICE is a spacecraft that was launched by the European Space Agency from French Guiana in South America, Kourou launch facility. And that thing is on the way. It launched in April, and it's going to go, you know, around the sun. It's going to use the Earth as a gravity assist to help get it out to Jupiter it really is not going to arrive there until 2031. So it's going to go around the Earth a couple of times. Each time it's going around the Earth, or I mean around the Sun a couple of times. Each time it goes around the Sun, it's going to pass the Earth and pick up a little speed from some gravity assist. But sooner or later, we'll get there at 2031. And then it should be able to do its science. And again, it's going to orbit the planet. But eventually, its goal is to get closer and closer to these different moons, including Europa. And the goal of, in the long term is, a couple of years after it's doing all this, we'll actually try to go into orbit around Ganymede. Ganymede is another Galilean moon. You have Io, Ganymede, Calypso, and Europa. But, it'll be the first time a spacecraft actually orbits another moon besides moon, what we call moon. And then actually before that one gets there, we're launching the Europa Clipper, and that will be launched on a SpaceX heavy vehicle, three Falcon 9s bolted together. And because of that, it's going to have a little extra speed, and it actually will get to Jupiter before the JUICE mission. Interesting thing about JUICE, because it launched a little over a month ago, the one main antenna, it's on a 52-foot long boom, and it's going to transmit, I believe it's like an 80-meter area. Remember reading the frequency one time, but it was in that category. And it's going to transmit signals through the ice of these different moons, like Europa, to try to determine, how deep is this ice, and how far would we have to go, how many miles would you have to go under the ice to actually get to this ocean. And by the way, they think there's so much water in this Europa that if you would add up all the water that's in there, it would be more than the water that we have here on Earth. Because Earth, the water goes down a couple of miles.
Good evening. The time is 10:55 p.m. Clear. Temperature 59 degrees.
Okay, I waited for that ID. Earth goes down miles, but Europa goes down, hundreds of miles. So the total amount of water on Europa would be more than what you have full on Earth. And that's the theory. And this JUICE was, one of the first things it had to do was open up this long mast. And on the end of the mast was these antennas. I'm not sure what they have different frequencies. They have, different instruments on board the spacecraft. But this mast didn't open. They commanded it to open. It's supposed to telescopically, open all the way to 52 feet. And that only went a little bit and then stopped. They realized that there's a pin in this mast that's supposed to retract that wasn't retracting, and they somehow figured it out. This is mission control. Now, this is a European Space Agency flight, so it's controlled out of Darmstadt, Germany. So mission control at Darmstadt figured out that this little pin is probably only a couple of millimeters. It's holding up this whole thing. So what they did is they tried to barbecue it a little bit, point that one side to the sun. They, put the thrusters on, whatever, pointed it toward the sun, heated it up, that didn't work, and they tried shaking it. They put the thrusters one way and then quick put the thrusters another way. And sooner or later, I guess, it was a combination of this and that. They figured out that the pin actually did move, which then they commanded the motor to come on again to extend this 52-foot mast, and sure enough, it worked. They're very happy. And then from there, once they did that, they were able to extend their other antennas, maybe whatever it is, like come off the end of it. I haven't seen a close-up of the antennas yet. But anyway, that's now... full operation, and by the time it gets there in 2031, maybe they'll be able to see what's under that ice in Europa. So, anyway, that's a long answer. Sorry about that. K2LORWS2N. Okay, let me see if I have it. I don't hear that station. Try again. K2LOR, I think I have that call, right? WS2N. Okay, nothing heard. Starting to run out of time. There was a launch this evening, around 10:35 Eastern Standard Time. And I got to see SpaceX launched from Launch Complex 39A, and it was a crew of four. And their goal is to go to the International Space Station, not for 6 months, but like they normally do. This one's only going to dock with the space station tomorrow and spend about 8 days or so, and then return to Earth. Now, why is that? Because it's a crew of four that NASA's not paying for. This is a private commercial mission. SpaceX is actually being paid as well. You have Saudi Arabian and two astronauts on board, and
complete
and a female. And then you have the commander is Peggy Whitson. Peggy Whitson is an astronaut. She's been up many, many times, NASA astronaut, to the International Space Station and all, and she's got like a record for the most. Collectively, the most amount of time that any, I believe, any woman, if not man, for America has accumulated, so plenty of experience. She retired from NASA, no longer works for NASA, so now she's employed by Axiom. Axiom is a company, and their goal is to put a space station into orbit, and they're way of doing it is they're going to send the module up to the International Space Station, dock with it, and then send another module and eventually another one, at least three different modules. Leave it that way and occupy it with their own crew members, a private company, and then as time goes on and NASA decides in the future to deorbit the space station, Axiom plans on separating from the space station with all these different modules, their own solar panels, and you know their own docking ports, and you know their own doorways to airlocks to go to do spacewalks, whatever it takes. That will eventually separate from the space station. But in the meantime, they were already paying, Axiom is already paying or organizing flights to the space station. And they're actually paying NASA to use their facilities. You know, they dock with the space station. They might use some of their food. They might use their bathroom facility. They might use their solar panel. They got the solar panel tower that helps supplement the power inside their Dragon spacecraft. So, but they are, you know, it's a crew of four, and they plan on doing science, their own science experiments, and then eventually returning in a short period of time. One of the guys that are going up, John Schulte, they call him the pilot. You know, the commander is Peggy Whitson, and John is pilot, and he really is a pilot. I mean, he's flown a lot of planes and all. It doesn't look like anything to do with the military, but he's quite a character. And he's paying for his own trip to get on a spacecraft. Looks like Saudi Arabia is paying the other two. And Peggy Whitson gets sent by Axiom to dock with the International Space Station. The ruling that NASA has is whatever you send up, meaning SpaceX, to dock with us, you can do it as long as the commander is, you know, ex or present NASA astronaut. So there's three paying people involved there. They're paying NASA, they're paying SpaceX for the flight up. They're paying NASA for the facilities. And this one guy, John Schultner, he's got his ham license. So does the two from Saudi Arabia. The one from Saudi Arabia, Ali Al-Queeny, I think it is 7Z1AJ, 7Zulu-1-8, Alpha Juliet. And then Rianda Barnall, she's a 7Z1RB. But John Schultz, he's from, I think, Tennessee. He's K04MJC, which is different. Most of these astronauts that I see go up, NASA trains, all have five calls. And why do they have that? Because they get trained down in Texas. And while they're there, you know, you guys really should get your ham license. So that's why they most of them wind up with five calls. This guy had a poor call because he had it when he was younger, like 13 years old. Now, I don't know, I guess he looks like he's about, you know, 59, 60 years old. He's been around a while. But when he was 13 years old, he had a ham license and he worked on radios. Into things, photography and all that you read about. But he had his license when he was young, so he's got this, this case, KO4MJC call. And I watched the launch, and actually, you know, I was watching on the computer because I always go to SpaceX. This is SpaceX launch. They'll put it on live. But I also had CNN on in the background, and sure enough, CNN put the launch on. You know, as time goes on, you know, you start to wonder if the news media is going to put any of these launches on. But they did. They put on the whole launch, and they showed the first stage, for the first time coming, you know, for the first time when you had a crew launch, the stage actually went back to Cape Canaveral and landed on Landing Zone 1, they call it, and which used to be Launch Complex 13 years ago, but they took it over from NASA direction, but they took it over from Cape Canaveral. Military owns that part of it. So this first stage came down, and instead of landing on a drone ship 400 miles out of sea, it did a boost back burn, did a burn through the atmosphere and a landing burn, and that one went perfectly. And now this crew is on their way to the International Space Station. Well, John is, you know, is they said, I was watching CNN and I could hear it. They said one of the first things he's going to do is he's going to get on a ham radio. You know, we have two ham radios attached to the International Space Station. One is in the Zvezda module that Russians have, and the other one is in the Columbus module that we have up in the front of the space station. So he's actually anxious to get on and start working with people. I don't know if there's arrangements for schools or if he's going to do this randomly or not. I haven't figured that out yet. Went to the AMSAT website. I didn't see any. I mean, I saw the information all about him and his call letter and all, but I didn't see anything about if he had planned contacts for schools. But, you know, you might have. I'll have to check up the, you know, there's the Ares amateur radio on the International Space Station. They might have it. So it's getting late. Let me just say thanks to everybody that stood by and listened to me on the station. That asked a good question about Europa. And let me turn it back to Dr. Roy. Tomorrow we'll be on ClubNet, Club InfoNet. Comes on tomorrow at 8:30 on these frequencies, followed by the Slapper Shop. Roy, over to you. AC2GS, WS2N for the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. Back to you, Roy.
Thank you very much, Paul. WS2N, this is AC2GS, and
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. I appreciate it especially. So another thank you. And thank you to everyone who participated tonight. It doesn't work very well if I talk to myself, so I appreciate the company. And I hope that you'll join me and the rest of us again next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we attempt to do it all over again. I already told you the link. I'd like to quote Dick, K2RW. He would end most of his nets with, "Be kind to each other." I like to quote Epictetus, an ancient Roman philosopher. "It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows, so try and keep your mind open to learn new things. It's fun to learn new things." And, that's it for tonight. Have a great week, everyone. Be well, stay safe, and come back next Sunday, and we'll do it all over again. Our rebels now are done. Slava Ukraine. Is AC2GS clear?
Okay, I second the Ukraine as well. Roy, I don't know if you heard me, but what do you think? Do people that have tumors in their ear, when they take it out, is there a possibility that these people are very dizzy because they're cutting the, doing something to their nerves? Anyway, that was part of the article that I read. With NASA.
Yeah, I mean, the inner ear has the vestibular devices that tell us where we are in three dimensions. That's why we get dizzy when we spin around a lot. Sometimes when you get an inner ear infection, you develop vertigo. So it's a very common complication of inner ear problems to have vertigo, which can make you feel sick as a dog and cause you to throw up and just feel rotten.
Okay. Again, that was on a NASA site, so I figure that's true. Any other site, I'd have my doubts. You know, what they even would put that on their site. But, I don't know, if you go to that NASA site, you bring up this gadget, release the Kraken, it's cool. It's actually a serious story about what they plan on doing with astronauts. They put two people inside this gadget. I mean, if you see this thing move around, there's no way in the world I would get on this thing. I mean, it looks like the craziest ride that anybody would ever try to attempt.
Well, they put astronauts through all kinds of ridiculous rides, and they used to do that with experimental pilots because of G-factors and such. So, you had the Vomit Comet, you had those things that spun you around and around and around. So you're trying to find the physical limits of astronauts because they need to know them, because they need to know how much they can force them to do.
Yeah, okay. But this thing's a simulator. You know, you sit inside and you've got windows all around you. You look on this computer screens probably. And it's duplicating the sky and clouds, and it starts moving. And like I said, it could move in six different axes. So, the computer's hooked up to this thing. And then if you go forward, it's the whole gadget. It's like a 100-ton machine. It will actually go forward. It's got it looks like a 100-foot run. So you get the feeling of acceleration, with deacceleration. It's quite a machine, and it's not even a NASA machine. This is from the Air Force. NASA just wants to borrow it. But really fascinating. I never heard of it before until a couple of days ago when I read about it.
Yeah, they probably have been using it for their test pilots. There's all kinds of, they have a big, big, big budget. I don't know if you've ever seen, there are these weird personal versions, which are much scaled down, where they strap you in, and you basically, like, you're sitting in the middle of a giant ball bearing, and you can rotate in the X, Y, and Z axis to your heart's content before you throw up.
Okay, very good. Yeah, well, this, the idea of this is not, you know, not to make anybody sick. The idea of this is to see if somebody can control a plane in flight. But not the one.